Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
Doing well. I missed you last week.
I know. I'm glad to have you back. Yeah. I don't like running the sound.
Yeah, and you didn't say that the catchphrase, Jasmine.
I know. I was really sick. I'd actually just left the doctor's office before coming and recording that podcast. Well, so I was delirious.
Well, you couldn't tell. The episode was very good. Thank you so much for persevering without me. Thank you to Clay Kennedy for filling in for us. Thank you to Chris Hughes for writing the notes. But this week, we have plenty of new stuff. We spoke with Kelsey Hayes Coots, a teacher at the Marion C. Moore School, who is active with the Our JCPS campaign to stop the state takeover of JCPS. We spoke with her. It was a very good conversation. I'm excited for you guys to hear it. But before we talk to her, we are going to tell you about plenty of other news items. Jasmine is going to start by talking about Bevin's House. Matt Bevin's House is in the news again, much to my mother's chagrin.
Right.
We are also going to talk about changes to the Medicaid system yet again. Then we are going to talk a little bit about Bevin and Boards, a story which will never end. And then we will end by talking about the end of Camp Compassion, the Occupy ICE movement in Louisville. So without any further ado, let's get into talking about Matt Bevin's House.
All right. So Tom Loftus of the Courier-Journal, known to Matt Bevin as #PeepingTom, brought us a new update about Matt Bevin's home in Anchorage. So a couple months ago, we brought this, well, we didn't. Tom Loftus brought this story back, and we talked about it on the podcast that there was a new valuation of the home that valued it at much higher than the one last year did. The Jefferson County PVA has retained a Louisville appraiser, Otto Spence, and he says that the appraisal that valued the property at $1.39 million is misleading and lacks clarity of development and communication in more than 30 different ways.
Right. And this isn't surprising to us, right? Because when we talked about it on the show, there was like a whole bunch of stuff about how he didn't get access to the full property.
Right. He was only allowed on certain floors and things like that. So an outside appraiser has been retained and says there are a lot of issues with that lower valuation. John May is the appraiser who valued the home last year. Otto Spence, the newly retained appraiser, said that May didn't use market data in his appraisal, and he also didn't agree with the process that he used to value the home and the land. So, you know, I guess he's saying it's like with police officers. There's standard operating procedures, and he's kind of saying he didn't use market data and didn't use the right process. So that's what the outside appraiser has said. Spence appraised it at somewhere between $2.9 and $3.5 million. So the PVA went with the lower end of Spence's appraisal at $2.9 million, which is still a lot more than $1.39 million.
Right. And again, he bought the house for, what, $1.6 million or something like that?
Something in the ones.
Yeah. I think it was, yeah, $1.5, $1.6. So this brings it back to like almost double. The appraised price that Mr. Spence gave it was about double what he actually paid for that property.
Right. And the 2.9 is about what it was thought to be valued at when this whole saga first began.
Right.
Bevin has appealed the new appraisal, and his attorney, Mark Summer, said that there were three real estate experts on that appeals board that accepted the valuation, and that since the PVA didn't appeal the finding back then, John May's appraisal should be the one that stands. He also said that hiring an outside appraiser has improperly singled out Bevin because he's a Republican. So he's kind of saying this is political, improper, and maybe even illegal.
He is a Republican, but he's also the governor.
Right. Exactly. The PVA's chief of staff, Colleen Younger, says that the new valuation was required because the parcel of land was separated from a larger parcel this year. And so that's why it was required. That's why they did a new valuation. But here's the important side note. Colleen Younger is running for PVA against John May.
Whoa, wait a minute. He was the one that did that. We just talked about him. He was the one that gave the low price.
John May is the appraiser that gave the low value. Colleen Younger is the current PVA's chief of staff that said that they had to do the new valuation. and they're running against each other.
And
Colleen is the Democrat,
right.
And John May is the Republican.
So that's a partisan race. So John May is a Republican running for as a Republican for the PVA's office and gave a very low price to Bevin's house.
Yes.
And Colleen Younger is a Democrat who's running for office and is trying to like say that they needed to have more work around this price because it was a bad price. Like calling into question Mr. May's work.
Yes.
Right. Whew, man. Very dramatic. Like this story just, it is a little silly, but it.
Right.
It,
and then there's all these little political intricacies going on within it.
Right. I mean, but at the end of the day, I mean, we're not neutral parties in this by any stretch of the imagination, but it does seem like that there is a pretty clear graft going on. Like Matt Bevin bought a house for what everyone except for John May seems to accept was worth about close to $3 million for about half that. There you go. That's a little wild.
That's our new update on Bevin's house.
Okay. Jasmine, the Medicaid system, we are going to update you about that as well. So we told you about the Bevin administration's surprise cuts to Medicaid expansion's dental and vision benefits a few weeks ago. And again, they happen on the heels of the work requirement, like the work requirement that the Bevin administration tried to add to Medicaid. It lost in court and was not allowed to proceed. And then the Bevin administration cut dental and vision benefits for the people who would have been subject to the work requirement. All the people on the expansion is about 500,000 people. Then, on Thursday, July the 19th, the Bevin administration restored all those cuts. They just came back. The Bevin administration said, quote, changing benefits and coverage is not as easy as flipping a single switch, unquote. But Jasmine, it does seem to me that it seems like they just flipped a switch and turned them back on.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Okay, well, one other piece of wrinkle in this is that on July the 18th, which is, again, the day before that they were restored on July the 19th, Deborah Yetter of the Courier Journal, who's a great writer who focuses on healthcare a lot.
Love Deborah Yetter.
Yeah, she's great. She wrote a very harrowing piece in the Courier Journal, which detailed on a personal level the impact of those cuts on the lives of Medicaid beneficiaries. It's like people who were like, you know, I had this oral surgery scheduled. I desperately need it. This was the first time I was going to be able to have access to this sort of care. And all of a sudden, those benefits have been ripped away from
Turns
me.
Out, maybe doing things like that hurts real people.
Right. I mean, exactly. And then all of a sudden, the day after this story comes out, on July the 19th, the Bevin administration restores all these cuts, right? So another reason, okay, they did say that, you know, it's difficult to do this. We were working on it. But a reason that the Bevin administration cited for restoring those cuts is that CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the group that was actually sued, the people that administrate the Medicare and Medicaid system on a federal level, CMS is planning a new 30-day comment period. The Bevin administration said that they were hoping for a really quick reapproval by CMS, and then they would be able to just kind of roll with this. But the comment period means that, well, actually, it will be a while before that this is able to be reinstated. So they were like, well, since we're going to have to wait, we might as well turn them back on because we're going to have to wait. Jasmine, I'm burying the lead on this. There's going to be a new comment period.
Right, and if you listen to our podcast regularly, you know that comment periods are really important and that leaving comments is important. Kara Stewart came on and talked about that lawsuit and how important the comments were to the judge. And then when we got the ruling, he talked about the comments.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, in other conversations I've had about this, a lot of people have cited the incredible job that the activists in Kentucky, including Kara Stewart, I mean, led by Kara Stewart, let's not dance around it. She was leading the charge to get people to comment on the original comment period. Other states did not have that same sort of support, and they're having a little bit of trouble, more trouble than Kentucky, at getting these lawsuits off the ground. So this is important. It's important to leave comments, so please do that. Jasmine, meanwhile, there's other pieces of news about the Medicaid program in Kentucky. Fitch Ratings, which is a bond ratings agency, they're very important to, you know, the debt markets. Fitch Ratings, they issued a report saying that Kentucky's Medicaid administration cost increased 40% in the new biennium, which is a $35 million increase. The report points out that the work requirements require a level of monitoring of work status that no state has ever implemented. This is a quote from the report. Quote, states developed systems in the 1990s to implement work requirements for welfare called the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, but the scale of Medicaid is significantly larger now. TANF enrolled 2.4 million people monthly during 2017. Medicaid enrolls 67.3 million people in April 2018 alone, unquote. So the Medicaid administration costs have really skyrocketed. They have gone up by 40%. And you know, the Bevin administration says, we'll probably say, you know, that's one-tenth of the savings we hope to recoup from this new Medicaid work requirement. We're cutting that. But you're also putting at risk federal dollars and also the fact that if you enroll people in healthcare and pay for their healthcare, it helps solve problems later on. If you're able to get people into the healthcare system, get them good primary care, they don't have to, you know, have heart attacks later, which cost a lot of money to treat. Jasmine, last point about this. Jerry Vitti, he's a CEO of a company that connects beneficiaries to benefits providers. He said, quote, "Many people covered by the Medicaid expansion actually work. Those who do not often have a disability or care for someone else with a disability and thus can't work," unquote. Jasmine, the points that were made in this Fitch report are points that have been made by Medicaid advocates for many years.
Right.
Yeah, this
exactly.
It's like, hey, it turns out that one side was right and the other was wrong. By and large, changing the Medicaid expansion will do less and cost more. So we shouldn't do it. That's all I have to say about that. All right, Jasmine, one other thing, another issue I want to talk about. Matt Bevin and boards, a never-ending story. Jasmine, our very first episode, which, you know, we're getting close to 100 at this point, but our very first episode featured a segment about Governor Bevin's use of executive power to reshape boards. And he is at it again, this time changing several of Kentucky's education boards. Governor Bevin issued an executive order on July the 13th that altered the composition of Kentucky's two largest education boards, the Council for Postsecondary Education and the Kentucky Board of Education. The changes to these boards include new membership requirements, including requiring that one member of KBOE being someone with, quote, background as an entrepreneur. Jasmine, do you think being an entrepreneur is important to the education system? Potentially? Maybe?
I don't know. I can't really think of why that should be a requirement.
Right. Yeah.
Like self-starter skills are nice and everything, but I don't really understand why you have to have one.
Right. I mean, here's the thing, too. You know, clearly Matt Bevin cares very passionately about entrepreneurship. Like, you know, and that's okay. Like, having a governor that's, like, very passionate about entrepreneurship, like, in a box by itself is actually, you know, not a bad thing. It's good. I think it's good to have a governor that's an entrepreneur, potentially. But the thing is, like, that means you should appoint people to KBOE who are entrepreneurs, not force other governors to do that as well. You know what I mean? That seems a little crazy. And all you're doing is opening the door for later on a different governor to just change it later. Okay, Jasmine, in addition to the two biggest boards being altered, eight other boards were what's called abolished and reconstituted, which if you go back and listen to the first episode, you did a very good job of explaining exactly what that means. But many people are not going to want to do that, so I'm going to re-explain this. Basically, that means that the boards are totally torn down, they're abolished, that means they aren't existed, and they're completely reconstituted. All of the requirements are completely changed. The eight other boards that had that happen to them, they are boards that deal with issues surrounding the education system, such as school safety, gifted and talented children, school curriculum, and standards and practices. The changes to the composition of these boards require more participation from parents or, quote, members with private sector experience, unquote, a little bit like that entrepreneurship thing. Like, you know, maybe something you want to promote, but maybe not something you should enshrine in the board's, you know, documents that govern it. One thing that I did think was interesting, and actually I think it might be a good idea, is that the school safety board now requires a member to have been, quote, affected by school violence or a lockdown incident. And I think having somebody on the school board that's been impacted by that's probably a good idea. I mean, I think that that's a change that everybody could potentially get behind.
Yeah.
Jasmine, one board, in addition to the two big boards that were changed and the eight that were abolished and reconstituted, one board was outright abolished and not reconstituted.
So it's just gone.
It's gone. And it's called the Council for Community Education, and their mission was linking community needs to the education system. So making sure that if there was a need inside of a community, that the education system around that community was working towards meeting that need. It didn't seem like, based on the minutes that were published on their website, that they had met all that often, and maybe they weren't as functioning as they should have been. But instead of trying to, you know, change the system, they just got rid of it. I mean, it's one thing to do. Jasmine, the governor's rationale for doing this is KRS 12.028. And that statute allows the governor to change boards while the legislature is not in session. However, if the legislature does not approve these changes, the changes will expire and these boards will just revert to the system that they were before.
Right. And we have a very Republican-controlled legislature, so they'll probably approve them. But there's elections.
There are elections. And before the next legislative session, there will be an election. And the composition of the General Assembly will change.
Right.
So, you know, if the Democrats do manage to take one chamber in the next elections, it's highly likely that that chamber would not allow these changes to go through. But who knows? You know, it's also possible that if the governor is really passionate about making sure that we get plenty of entrepreneurs on these education boards, that the Democrats could use that as a bargaining chip for something that they want to do. There's all sorts of things that could happen if we have divided government. But who knows? Jasmine, we're here, and we will keep track of this.
We will.
All right, Jasmine, tell us about Camp Compassion.
So after 17 days of camping in front of the ICE office, the Department of Homeland Security and dozens of LMPD officers begin dismantling the Occupy ICE camp on, I believe, July 19th. There was also even a SWAT team lined up across the street during the raid. LMPD called it seizing abandoned property. That's a way to characterize it, I guess.
Right. Huh. Interesting. Right.
Chief Conrad's statement, he's LMPD police chief for non-Louisville folks, said that they tried to be patient with the protesters, but they failed to comply with state and federal laws after multiple requests. LMPD also said that protesters began to infringe on parking spaces and that there were some public health concerns over how the camp was handling human waste.
Right. So yeah. I mean, in the midst of all this, like, you can give lots of reasons, but I don't think LMPD has been exactly above board in all of this. And I don't know if, you know, that would be gross if it were true, but I don't have any real reason to take them at their word.
Right. I don't think the way they phrased it was an issue. I know that maybe people were using restroom facilities at a White Castle nearby and things like that. But LMPD tried to turn this into public health and safety issues. LMPD also said that during the 17 days the protesters had been there, there were several calls for service in the area, but there was no elaboration on what kind of calls for service or what that meant.
Or if that was out of the ordinary. I mean,
Right. So we talked a couple weeks ago about the notices that they've been given about compliance with the ADA, but last Thursday they gave them basically a 15-minute warning at 6 a.m., They began moving and throwing things away shortly after, and then the camp was gone by 9. And now steel fences line the street where the camp once stood. Occupy ICE released a statement. They said that they were never actually served with an official notice before the raid. They said that property was illegally seized. LMPD basically had like a trailer, and they loaded it onto the trailer, and it was taken to the LMPD property room. And just from experience in my profession, getting things back from the property room is really difficult.
Yeah.
I've had to get 3 different written court orders to help a client get property back. And I was getting official court orders and they didn't look the way they wanted.
Yeah, it's really messed
and,
up.
And it was incredibly difficult for a client to get their property back. The notice from LMPD said that they were there just to seize abandoned property. Occupy ICE in their statement made a really good argument. Why was there a need for the SWAT team and an arrest wagon for collecting abandoned property? Abandoned property can't fight back. So why did they need this heavy presence and a SWAT team and a paddy wagon?
I mean, maybe they thought that they were working on like robots or something at the Occupy ICE camp and they were afraid they're going to have to arrest the robots.
Maybe.
I doubt it. No, it seems probably like that they were actually trying to arrest the Occupy ICE people, potentially.
Right, but there were no arrests or any issues like that. Occupy ICE also said in their statement they believe LMPD violated a Louisville Metro Council eviction notice ordinance that requires 3 weeks before evicting. So
That seems a little weird to me, though, because you have to, like, be in a physical property before you're, like, you can't be evicted from a tent. I don't know.
Right. I haven't read the Louisville Metro Council ordinance, so I don't know. Occupy ICE's statement was really good, and they made a lot of good points. And like we talked about a couple weeks ago, this whole thing, you know, LMPD is using the guise of safety and public health to intimidate them, and they're using legalities to get them out of there.
Yeah.
Basically. On Twitter, Mayor Fisher said, protesters can continue to exercise their First Amendment rights so long as they are legally compliant. But the Occupy ICE camp is down. They are no longer in front of the ICE office. I'm sure that they aren't going away, though. I don't know what's next for them, but, you know, they seem well organized and passionate about their cause. And I know that I think that they've had, you know, engagements outside of where the camp was at this point. But LMPD came in, they raided, and they are no longer there.
Yeah. Okay. So, Jasmine, we haven't talked any about the Metro Explorers case because it's a pretty Louisville-centric thing, and, you know, we want to stay focused. But that's been a big thing in Louisville, right? And you know way
yes.
more about this than I do.
And I've thought about this for a future newsletter because it's incredibly fascinating. Clay, that was on the podcast last week, knows a lot about it. So I've actually talked to him about this, maybe writing this story one day, but it's a pretty big police scandal in Louisville.
It's a huge police scandal, and it's kind of impacting the mayor. And I think that some of the voters that the mayor is really counting on to vote for him in the upcoming election are people who are going to be more worried about the Explorers case than the Occupy ICE thing. I think Occupy ICE is popular as a movement among more liberal and more progressive people, but more moderate voters in Louisville don't necessarily care as much about it. You know what I mean? Like more moderate Democrats. And I think that because the Explorers case was really getting hot last week in the news, the reason that this might have happened was because of the Explorers case. That's my pet theory for right now. Yeah. So that's kind of one of the reasons I think this happened. I think it's a shame. I think that, you know, I didn't go down there because there's, you know, it's hot, and you know, I probably should have because I do support getting rid of ICE, or at least like replacing it with something more humane. But I think that it's a shame that they did this. I don't think that it was a good policy. So I hope that the Occupy ICE people can continue to exercise their First Amendment rights and don't give up just because of this. So,
and I don't think they will.
Yeah, me either. Jasmine, only one quick hit. Oh wait, I have a second quick hit. But the first quick hit is really exciting news. Alice Lonergan Grimes, the Kentucky Secretary of State, is having a baby boy. She's expecting. So that's good for
right.
her.
Right. Congratulations.
I think it's due
to
on
the secretary.
Due on the same day, maybe on the same day, but around the same time as my sister's first kid. So there you go. They could be, maybe they'll be born on the same day. Who knows?
Maybe.
Yeah. Another quick hit, Jasmine. I just saw this, and this just happened right before we started recording. Morning Consult, who is a polling firm. They poll nationally. They're one of the most well-respected. But they do occasional update on gubernatorial approval ratings. And Matt Bevin is now rated in the Morning Consult poll, which they rated all 50 governors across the state. Matt Bevin is the fourth least popular governor in the entire United States, behind some people who have some serious, serious problems going on. And he, yeah, so 29%, I think, was his approval rating, 60-something percent disapproval rating. Not good for him. So,
yeah, not great.
Yeah, not too surprising, though. All right, Jasmine, let's talk to Kelsey Hayes Coutts.
Kelsey Hayes Coutts is an eighth grade language arts teacher at the Marion C. Moore School. She's an organizer with Kentucky 120 United, and she's active with the RJCPS movement, which opposes the state takeover of Jefferson County Public Schools, which we've mentioned here on the podcast before. Ms. Coutts is an alum of Teach for America and has been active in many political causes in Kentucky over the past several years. So, Kelsey, welcome to my Old Kentucky podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
All right, so we're here to talk about RJCPS today. RJCPS opposes the state takeover of the Jefferson County school system, but the state audit of JCPS did reveal some substantial issues with the district. Why is a state takeover the wrong solution to fixing these problems?
Yeah, so before I even tell you that, I do want to say that nobody in the RJCPS coalition or any teachers are arguing that JCPS is perfect at all. Like, you cannot ignore that there are an achievement gap and a large racial disparity in some of our scores. So nobody is saying that, you know, ignoring that fact, which sometimes comes out in social media with our critics or our opponents, to act like that we don't, you know, we're saying that that doesn't exist. But One reason is because it takes away local control of our school board. So whether or not you are a teacher, school employee, parent, whatever, if you vote for a school board member, which if you vote, then you do, then it essentially could take away their power, and they would be advisory only. So again, that takes away local control. And then another is because we really want to focus on like opportunity for all students. And under the state takeover, there could be a repurposing of schools. That's where they could bring in the charter schools, move teachers around. Like there's a whole lot of scenarios in which could happen. But the way our system is now, it at least tries to ensure opportunity for all students, you know, regardless of zip code. So
okay. So one of those major issues that hangs over the audit of JCPS and the potential state takeover is the fact that the superintendent changed during the period in which the audit took place. So even the Commissioner of Education, Wayne Lewis, has expressed support for the new superintendent, Marty Polio. Tell us a little bit about how the district has started moving in the right direction under his leadership.
You will hear me say a lot or see me post on social media that I believe and many others believe that we have the right people in the right seats now. And that refers to your question in terms of we believe, and I say we because the majority of, teachers that I've talked to and people in the Our JCPS movement, that Dr. Polio is the guy. He's our guy to kind of lead us, you know, through this. Part of it is whenever he first came and was the interim, his whole goal was to focus on the culture and climate of JCPS, especially in terms of staff. And you could feel it, and it was badly needed. Just sort of the morale as a district and as working for the district wasn't very high. And so I think that also gave him a lot of credibility. But actual policies that he's instituted to help kids or to kind of show that he's moving in the right direction for kids, because obviously that's what this is about. I want to say a couple months ago, I think in May, the school board instituted a racial equity policy, which really it has a little bit of teeth to it, as you say. It's not necessarily just something that's like on paper that everybody rubber stamped. It was, I think, unanimously passed by the school board, and then all the people that were at the school board meeting kind of spoke in favor of that policy. But it is a plan really to reduce the disproportionate suspensions of, you know, there's clearly like a racial disparity
if
you look at suspensions, yeah. And then also it's going to increase the advanced program participation for our students of color. And so, you know, that racial equity policy has been kind of applauded and absolutely, you know, it's been absolutely needed. Also, he's hired a lot of great people and really sort of reorganized the district. I was at school this morning and something that our principal said was that we need to, that he heard Dr. Polio say, is that we need to become a school system, not a system of schools. And what he meant by that is because previously we were organized into areas. So we had like area superintendents that were over elementary, middle, and high. And now we are back to being leveled. And so the people that are over those schools, they can really focus on, you know, how you run an elementary school is very different than how you run a high school. And so we can help there. He's also brought in Dr. Carmen Coleman, who is really well known in her field. And they have started this new initiative called the Backpack of Success Skills. This is going to shift the focus of students starting this year and teachers from necessarily testing, which obviously we still have testing in the state of Kentucky, but towards kind of that, you know, multiple choice type, you know, that's the only thing that really matters, to there's these competencies sort of that you would have to perform in the real world, right? Like public speaking, like we're doing now, or certain things. These kids will have a digital, like, quote, backpack, and at critical points, so eighth grade, which I teach, for example, students will have to defend why they should go to the next grade. And they will have to show, you know, based off of those competencies or based off of those, you know, buckets of things that they kind of have to check off, they will have to defend how they've met those. And so that is really going to not only kind of bring forward for our students, you know, us into the 21st century or to the, you know, quote, like new age, but also really put, I guess, ownership into our kids' hands in terms of their own learning, right? They're going to be able to say, I realize that I'm not good at X, this specific thing, but I've done these three things to work on that, and this is how I've gotten better. They're going to really be able to talk about kind of their learning and how they've gotten better. And so that's being applauded by many, and it's a new initiative that everybody's really excited about, because again, it goes towards that deeper learning versus instead of just like I can answer A, B, C, D, you know, very well and learn how to game the system. So
I'm hearing kind of like a combination of morale, new policies, and some different organization is why you think that Dr. Polio's the guy.
Then. Yeah, and it's like a breath of fresh air to not be so focused on testing, which obviously that's just the nature of the beast. Like, that's what's in the Courier Journal, and people say that, you know, your kids are scoring at this level. We're not ignoring that, because everything's still standards based.
Right.
It just shows room for growth and shows that kids, you know, are not necessarily like a novice, apprentice, proficient, distinguished.
And it also seems a little interesting that all of these things have come to the fore in the past year or so since that audit was you know, released, and the takeover was kind of announced in the midst of all these changes already happening. Mm-hmm. So like, it was clear that JCPS is trying to address the issues that are brought up in the audit, yet still there was a takeover that was announced. So that seems a little unusual to me.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like Robert said, the proposed takeover was announced about 2 weeks after the General Assembly adjourned, where public school teachers were a major presence in Frankfort. How much of the takeover do you think is maybe political punishment for the protests that took place in Frankfort?
I get that question a lot, actually, and I believe probably other people in the RJCPS coalition do too. And I don't really like it, because it almost seems like it's the fault of the grassroots groups, you know, or the people that were rising up. And I would say that it's the opposite, you know, that, you know, my answer to that really is that Governor Bevin has had a plan all along. And if he didn't meet his end game and you know, with plan A, he was going to go to plan B. And if plan B doesn't work, he's going to go to plan C, because all of this is a war on public education, and obviously Louisville too, but more so, you know, it's like multifaceted. Mm-hmm. And this is just one piece of the puzzle. So I don't think that it's like, quote, political punishment. I just
like
think
this was in motion.
Yeah,
maybe
I think this plan has been in motion all along, and this is just the way that he's going about it. Now.
Yeah,
you know?
I think that's evidenced by the fact that, you know, JCPS has done so much to approach the audit that they were given, and yet still it was, you know, decided that they needed to undergo a takeover.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so JCPS's contract with the teachers union, it expires on June 30th, which means it's already expired because it's July.
Yeah.
So takeover supporters hope to do away with much of the contract. And, you know, a lot of these people who support the takeover, they point to the power of the teachers union and the ability of teachers to transfer between schools as they gain experience as a driver of the racial achievement gap in Jefferson County. You mentioned a little bit about the racial achievement plan that was put in place by JCPS.
The equity plan?
Yeah, the racial equity plan. Right, exactly. But what do you think? What's your response to the people who give you that reasoning for supporting the takeover?
That kind of operates under the assumption that absent a formal process, that people wouldn't transfer.
Right.
You know, and I just think that that's false. I mean, you can't keep people, you know, force people into certain schools or certain like workplaces. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that would be the opposite of what we would want to do anyways, because you want teachers and school employees to feel comfortable where they are, that they're in a place that's a good fit for them. And if it's not, maybe they do need to move on, because essentially the people that are going to be, you know, on the other end of that are kids every single day. And so I just think that that doesn't make sense. There's also a little bit of evidence to back that up from Education Week. They ran, I think it was in New Orleans, a study that actually studied exactly that point, and it showed that it actually did the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. So if there wasn't a formal plan in place, more people were moving, and it was more negatively affecting schools that we don't want them to negatively affect. So
yeah, I feel like those two points actually work together, where you were talking about the teachers protesting being the reasoning behind why the governor did this. And this is also this question about teachers being able to move. It kind of seems to be like people want to blame teachers for this.
Yeah. And oh, absolutely.
Yeah. That seems to be what the goal is there.
And I was just going to say that what you'll notice a lot with some of the talking points or some of the points that are made from, I guess, our critics or our opponents, they're always like pointing the finger to this one thing, right? It's the teachers unions. If we just did this. And what I say to that is, like, if we really want to get serious about what works, you know, then we should do that.
Right.
Let's not say that we have fully funded public schools when, you know, when you compare it to inflation, it's still like behind what it was in 2008.
Absolutely.
You know, and so we can do this back and forth all day long. But again, if we're really like putting kids at the central of it, it should be what I always say is like people over politics, right? And right now, our education system is not shielded by politics, which it should be. And it's only going to kind of ramp up from here as we see what happens with the hearings that are about to take place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, which I guess it leads us to our next question, which is that the next step in the process is an appeal of the takeover. And that decision was made in December. The appeal will actually occur into September and October. But one of the issues I see is the appeal is decided by the same 11 people who actually voted for the takeover in the first place.
That's not how appeals usually work.
Right. Well, it is in the executive branch. This leads me to the question, do you actually think that there's a prospect for the appeal to be successful? And what do you think that the goal should be during these hearings?
I mean, obviously, I think anybody that's paying attention is very concerned that, you know, we hope that the Kentucky board will be objective during the hearing. I see your faces right now. You're kind of making it, you know, smirking a little bit. But I think that especially given really like how quickly they replaced the commissioner and how the recommendation came so quickly after that, we're not willing to like concede that this is a lost cause, right? So right now our goal totally is about education of the community, right? Because I think that they are already seeing that there has been a lot of, I guess, backlash or a lot of people that they probably thought that wouldn't be as engaged in this process have been.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to change their phone numbers at the board. They had to change their emails. They actually had to hire another staffer to be able to handle this. And the RJCPS Coalition has been canvassing. There's been a whole social media campaign. There's been over 10,000 signatures that have been collected, you know, and that will be delivered during those hearings. Also, if the board, I guess, isn't objective, because some have been against it in social media, right, or in other public spaces,
really,
that would be more so of like grounds that it could, I guess, go to the Supreme Court, right?
Right.
Like at some point, if maybe some of them have to kind of step down or recuse themselves because they've been so on one side. So again, we don't know necessarily if all 11 are even going to be a part of the appeal process. Mm-hmm. So again, like, yeah, it's like regardless, the only thing that we can control is that we're not going down without a fight. We're not going to concede that it's a lost cause. So,
yeah, and there's always the prospect of judicial review where this could actually go into the court system. So I foresee that as the future. Okay, so, you know, there are some of Jasmine and my peers, you know, who are supportive of the mission of RJCPS, you know, but we're not students in school. We aren't teachers in school. We don't work in schools. We don't have any kids in school.
Mm-hmm.
Does RJCPS have a place for those kind of people?
Absolutely. So RJCPS is like a community coalition made up of people that, like me, you know, who obviously I'm a teacher and I directly work for a school in JCPS, but also it has a lot of groups across Louisville that are have people like the League of Women Voters, right? That maybe they're not all necessarily parents or grandparents, but they're still involved because, you know, this affects. It's bigger than either one political party, or it's bigger than just worried about one specific group. It's not about the teachers unions, right? It's about our whole community.
Right.
So really, if you wanted to get involved, I would say go to rjcps.org, I believe. If that doesn't work, go to .com. I think it goes to the same thing. But on there, it has to how you can get involved or how you can fight back. The first is every day that you can call the Kentucky Board and let them know that you oppose the state takeover. You can let them know why yourself, but there are also, if you get nervous or something, it prompts you through that on the website. You also can email. The tool makes it very easy because instead of sending 11 emails, you can do it once and it sends the email to all 11 board members. Then we are asking that people use the Our JCPS hashtag on Twitter and Facebook, and then also like the Facebook page, you know, follow on Twitter, kind of all that good stuff to continue to amplify the message that Our JCPS is putting out.
Absolutely.
If you want to really get involved, too, you can reach out to the coalition, and then we do have community canvases that go out to talk to folks in the neighborhoods to let them know about what's going on, and then also to get more petition signatures.
Awesome. Yeah, I did just check it, and ourjcps.org does indeed work.
Okay, good. So I've said it wrong before. That's
yeah, so that does work. I didn't check .com, but you're good with .org.
Okay, good.
Okay, so that's really great. So people can go to the website.
Yep.
A lot of stuff about amplification and a lot of good stuff about how if you are passionate about this, there's space for you to really be involved.
Absolutely.
So.
Also, as soon as the hearing gets closer, if you can clear your schedule and go, we're going to want to have all hands on deck.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's also way you can get involved.
Yeah. And you know, there's lots of people that listen in Louisville, but there's also lots of people that listen outside of Louisville. I mean, this could absolutely affect you too. So, be on your lookout. So, all right, Kelsey. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And good luck in the future. You know, we definitely hope for the success of our JCPS. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. They can like our Facebook page. You can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. And we also now have a weekly newsletter, which you can find and subscribe to at tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter. And last but not least, you can support us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. You can support our creation, help us with our hosting fees. And that's at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.